The Place to Be podcast is a proud member of the History of WWE.com website. The History of WWE.com features thousands of complete cards and detailed results from throughout wrestling history from legendary promotions across the country, in addition to informative columns and reviews. It is, of course, also the official home of the Place to Be podcast and Scott and Justin's pay-per-view reviews. Visit us at thehistoryofwwe.com or on Facebook by searching for History of WWE or the Place to Be podcast. For anything and everything wrestling, the History of WWE is always the place to be.
Yeah, Frank here, he's got his own billiard room.
Yes, what do you call it, Kramer?
The billiard room.
No.
The name.
The billiard?
Not the billiards.
It was...
Come on, everybody.
Come on.
We call it the place to be.
The place to be, yes. It's the place to be.
Then I shall be there.
Now, it's time. Live and in living color.
The Grandy Man can...
Time to play the game!
Well, you always left me satisfied and smiling, so...
That's what she said!
Why do I want this?
Yeah.
Because I want to make bank, bro. I want to get ass. I want to drive a Range Rover.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, it is now time for the Place to Be podcast. And now your hosts, Justin Rosero and Scott Criscolo.
Place to Be Nation, welcome to another great episode of the Place to Be Podcast. I am your co-host, Justin Rosero. With me, as always, is my PIC, Scott Criscolo. Scott, how you doing?
Good evening, JR. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to episode 81 of the Place to Be Podcast as the numbers tick away towards the big C note. And tonight, of course... It might be half your age, Art, but it is number 81 as we get close to the big C note, which Art's pretty close. As a matter of fact, I believe he's 94. Speaking of 94, how about that for a segue? Tonight on the Place to Be podcast, it is, of course, our weekly trip through V Squared. That is, of course, the Vintage Vault. And tonight we are in the summer of 1994. And we're heartfelt greetings to a certain family, because tonight we're going to focus on the family. It's a Hart family reunion. Very emotional.
Yes. Sad moment.
Very, very emotional. For on this evening will be the last time you see one of the greatest performers of all time on WWE television, WWF/E television. Tonight, in the Vintage Vault, we bring you SummerSlam 1994. That, of course, was the open usually given to you by either Gorilla or Vince, the 8 welcomes. Welcome to, welcome to, welcome to, welcome to. But on this night, it was delivered by someone with a little more effervescence. That is, of course, the voice of the Macho Man, Randy Savage. And indeed, he was the host. They wanted to give him something to do anyway. Why don't you, before we get into the, before I set the stage, why don't we just put this to bed now?
Yeah, Randy Savage's final WWF pay-per-view appearance.
Yep.
He would remain in the Raw commentary booth into October, and at that point, his contract was up, and he had to decide, did he want to hang on as the WWF's goodwill ambassador and Babe Ruth that Vince McMahon pictured him being, kind of taking that spot as Hulk Hogan was now gone? Or did he feel like he still had something left in the tank? He did. He felt like he could still go. So he left his contract. Vince McMahon actually wished him a farewell on an October Raw, a little emotional moment. And then on WCW Saturday night in December, he made his debut. Jumped ship with his old good old friend Hulk Hogan and all the rest of the crew. Mm-hmm. And then he would remain there until 2000. Finishing up his career, he would hit a couple indie shows after that, a couple spots in TNA. And, you know, he was one of those guys that everyone always waited. When's he going to come back? When's he going to mend the fences? Never really happened until the very end of the last couple of years. It was starting to crumble a little bit. It started to thaw a little bit with the WWF, or now WWE. You know, he made the video game. He was doing some appearances. But as we chronicled back at our tribute show back in, I think it was 32, his life unfortunately came to an end when he suffered a heart attack in May of this past year, 2011. So that is it, unfortunately, for the Macho Man. He's provided us with many great moments, many great matches to talk about here over these last however many vaults we've done here, 40-something, I guess. However many we've done.
Pretty like close.
You know, rest in peace, Randy. And of course, we always implore you to go back and listen to our great tribute to the Macho Man we did after he passed away.
Yes. Yep. I'll have to count. I don't think it's that many. It's probably what? Oh, no, it might be close to 40 now that I think about it. You figure 4 a year for about, that's 20. It might be close. Maybe we're in the low 30s, probably.
Yeah, probably around there.
Pretty close to 40. This is a sad one for someone like me who started watching wrestling even before Savage came on the scene in 1985. You know, every time we've done a vault, pretty much since WrestleMania 9, I felt like a little bit of the Federation years just slowly starts to wither away. And there's still some guys left in the company at this point that still you point to the, quote, Federation years, which a lot of people consider the timeline between 1985 and 1993. But with Savage gone, now you really feel like now the new generation is here. Now it's officially it.
Yeah, and it almost like he sets it up. He passes the torch with his little intro there saying, you know, this is the official the show led by the new generation. So he kind of cues it up for us.
Exactly. And that's it. So a sad moment because we would know that 16 years or 17 years later, his life would end and he would never come back.
His body slammed around the world on everybody's boat. It almost knocked the hole right through the bottom of the boat.
I wish he was still with us to do that now.
Yes.
But and you know what? Deep down inside, as much as people think he's a cold bastard, I think Vince regrets it too.
I'm sure.
I'd like to think he does. God rest your soul, Macho Man. You will always be a part of the. You will always be part of the Place to Be family. Always. All right. August 29th, 1994, live from the brand spanking new, shiny, just out of the box, United Center in Chicago, Illinois. So for the first and what turns out to be only time in the long history between the World Wrestling Federation and the Windy City, we have a Chi-Town pay-per-view not at the Rosemont Horizon. And as has been mentioned in the past with you and I on past shows, this is officially the first event ever in this building. I'm glad you find it so funny, Art. Obviously, later on that year, within a few months, the Chicago Bulls and the Chicago Blackhawks would set up shop here and have ever since. Mm-hmm. Old Chicago Stadium would be no more.
And then, of course, WCW would take over.
Yes, and Vince would go back to. Now, I don't know if it was just a relationship. Maybe he didn't like the way the people, you know, maybe he didn't like the way the building handled the show, or, you know, maybe he just was too, maybe Rosemont had something going on that night and they couldn't host it. I can't imagine what they would be doing.
I think it was just a pride thing, taking over this new building, you know, being the first show to emanate from this building. So I think that was mainly the reason. Then he wanted to go back home to Rosemont. And then, of course, WCW did come in and sign an exclusive deal, so it didn't matter anyway.
Right. So this would be the only time that the WWE would have a pay-per-view in this building. But what I find funny is, and we're not getting into it now because we're going far in the future. We can talk more about that point when we get there. But even after WCW went under, throughout the entire decade of the 2000s, Vince still never goes back there.
Yeah.
Stay loyal to
Rosemont.
Yeah, I mean, you would figure when they go back for WrestleMania 22, you'd thought he'd go there instead. But he didn't. He went to Rosemont. So, anyway, tonight we are at the brand spanking new United Center. And within a couple of months, both the Blackhawks and the Bulls would start anew. By the way, it would also be the last year. We wouldn't really get this for another 3 years, but this was a very special year for the NBA, 94-95, just on a side note, because as I was watching some games over the last few months at work, this would be the first year of the United Center, but for you, my friend, and for me, loyal, longtime New Englanders, this would be the final year, calendar year, 1994-95, of the Boston Garden.
Yep. A lot of changes. Arena world.
Yep. Well, it would close up in the spring, and then in 1995, what would start as the Chalmette Center, then, of course, would become the Fleet Center, and now is, of course, the TD Garden. Anyway, your announcers, back in the saddle, if you will, Vincent Kennedy McMahon, fresh off his acquittal and out of the neck brace.
Yes, magically healed.
Just imagine I'm trying to do this show with a stupid neck brace on all night. And, of course, in the color seat, Jerry the King Lawler. And, of course, the Macho Man, your host. Your attendance, sold out, 23,000. Definitely a sellout. Buy rate, 1.3, which actually isn't bad. Not bad. And, of course, your celebrity guests. We have a couple of celebrities. Leslie Nielsen.
Oh, all right, never mind.
Well, okay, well, sorry. The cops. Well, you had it in the intro on our page. By the way, follow along, of course, bigelow34.proboards.com. We'll get into the rest of those guys later. All right, we'll get into them later. But we have a couple celebrity guests. They don't start at the beginning. We'll let you know why they're on later. We have one dark match.
And there's actually some backstory to this match. It is Adam Bomb taking on Quang. Of course, they were both managed by Harvey Whippleman for most of 1994. But on May 28th, in a King of the Ring qualifying match between Bomb and the 1-2-3 Kid, Kid won after Quang attempted to interfere on Bomb's behalf. Quang accidentally spit green mist into Bomb's face, allowing the Kid to get the victory. Whippleman had Bomb and Quang work as a team, but the problems continued to develop over the weeks, and eventually they'd have an argument when facing 1-2-3 Kid and Sparky Plug, and they would end up splitting and facing each other on house shows leading up to their big, huge dark match here, of course, which Adam Bomb would win.
Yes. So there's your dark match. We have seven matches on the show tonight. A few of them are pretty solid, and we have a couple of duds. But
that's okay. Show though.
Yeah, good, interesting show. Let's get started. We had a tag team match between interesting little team here. Mm-hmm. What did you book this match?
I know, huh?
IRS and the great Scott Charles. Parentheses, Bam Bam Bigelow, taking on the World Wrestling Federation Tag Team Champions. Wait a minute.
Wait, what?
Yeah. No longer the World Wrestling Federation Tag Team Champions, the Head Shrinkers.
All right, we got a lot to talk about here. First of all, let's get into why IRS and Bigelow were teaming. That's okay. Because over the summer, Ted DiBiase decided to get into the managerial game and fired up his own corporation. His first find was the returning Nikolai Volkoff. Nikolai had been in the crowd in this cheap-ass suit every week on Raw, just kind of sitting there, and it was eventually revealed by Vince and the other commentators that he was broke and looking for work. So DiBiase hired him as his slave, basically, and his whole goal was to embarrass him. So Nikolai wore these little tights with the scent sign on him, and early on it was made like he was being forced into it. Eventually Nikolai just became one of DiBiase's loyal soldiers. It would actually last for a while, into 95.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then he would also sign up his good old friend IRS, who's his former tag team partner, of course. And then Bam Bam Bigelow split ties with his main squeeze, Luna Vachon, and he also hooked up with DiBiase. And DiBiase had one other charge that we'll get to later. So,
yes.
The Million Dollar Corporation in full effect here, just getting started. It looked like his men were in line for a tag title shot. Of course, it was hinted that DiBiase was throwing his money around and was able to get them this title shot.
Mm-hmm.
But on August 27th at a house show in Indianapolis, the Head Shrinkers lost the tag team titles to Shawn Michaels and Diesel, the Richer and Rosero Pulaski Street Dream Team.
Yeah, really?
And it's funny because it was actually that morning, Shawn and Diesel were guests on Regis and Kathy Lee, and they came out with the belts, and that's how we found out. Because I actually was off from, it was still the summer, I was off from school, and mm-hmm. I remember watching because they were going to be on, of course, anything Shawn Diesel, I was there. And they came out with the titles, and I couldn't believe it. Actually, I think I still have the show on tape somewhere. That's where they were first announced as champions, and then Lawler mentions the title change as the Head Shrinkers are coming out to the ring here. So what was originally supposed to be a tag title match is no longer a tag title match. This is a straight-up tag opener. IRS and Bigelow and the Head Shrinkers.
What was really the point of that? The night before? I mean, really?
Yeah, I don't know why they didn't just at least. I guess they probably wanted to show off Shawn and Diesel as champions on the show, doing the whole thing with them having all the gold and stuff like that. I mean, whatever. It's not like IRS and Bigelow were built up as major contenders that had earned this big title shot. So,
right.
I can see maybe why they would just keep it on them for one last show and have at least a tag title match on the show. But I'm fine with it not happening.
Yeah. No. Either way, it's fine. The match itself is, pretty straightforward, nothing earth-shattering. What were you thinking at the time about, were you getting excited about this DiBiase? I mean, you knew it was going to happen eventually. If he was floating around the company, it was like a perfect natural progression for him have a nice stable of guys, you know?
With Lawler back in the mix, it was obvious he wasn't going to be the main color guy at all. I think he was doing Challenge at this point, if I'm not mistaken. It was either mm-hmm. him. I know Johnny Polo was doing some commentary work as well, but I'm pretty sure DiBiase was on Challenge. And it made sense. He was such a good talker, and I think they just assumed his heat would naturally carry over to these guys,
right.
and he could be their mouthpiece. You know, IRS and Bigelow, decent talkers, but DiBiase, they could play up the whole him throwing his money around and buying these guys title matches and everything else. So I liked the theory. I thought it was definitely going to work, only because DiBiase is such a good talker and a good heat magnet. But it'll be something interesting for us to chronicle over the next year or so see if that really came to fruition.
Yes, exactly. Because he would gain guys and lose guys over the course of time, and we'll document it. The match isn't bad. The DQ ending was pretty dumb. I don't know. It really wasn't necessary. I just should have had a clean finish, but. The match itself is pretty basic. The crowd was hot. I tell you something. I liked the open. They were showing like the dark and all those like circles. That was like their cool little thing, like those circle lights that floated around the arena.
Yeah, that was the new generation. That's it. They found their new lights and their new little, what are those things called that they put over the lights to have the little
like the cutout kind of things.
Yeah. They had each guy's
shapes.
Each guy's little symbol or name graphic would twirl around in the ring. And, they were starting to experiment a little bit with pyro for a few guys. So this is definitely the next step in the evolution of their presentation. Uh-huh.
Yes, and they would have the open, that, like, octagonal or hexagonal-looking thing with and the logo would be there, and then the little screen would raise, and, yeah. So, I mean, they'd be doing that for a while. Glad you find it so funny, Vince. Hope you're excited. But this match hey, look, just saying. Maybe you thought it was great sitting at ringside, but at home, and I remember watching this show. Actually, no, this broke my streak of watching live SummerSlams. This was the first SummerSlam.
I don't do any tricks.
Probably could have used it in this match. Yeah,
This
was the first. This was the first SummerSlam I did not watch live. I rented it a couple months later.
This is a memorable one for me. This was actually the night before I started high school, so it was very interesting. It was kind of my swan song to my youth. So
yes.
I like this opener obviously because I like the four guys involved. I liked the look of this arena. It popped to me. It was like very open and very. I know it's weird to like define shows and looks by color, but it was always like a blue feel to me. It was like very blue. Mm-hmm. And but just it almost reminded me of WrestleMania 3 in a weird way, just the crisp look of it.
Right.
And I remember I remember the quality of the show always resonated with me because my cousin, for some reason, he purchased like an 8-hour tape instead of a 6, and he recorded it in SP, and it looked awesome. And I always remember watching this show and like really enjoying the whole look of it because the quality was so good. And the sound and everything, it just always kind of resonated with me. But, Asuka interferes at the end. And I guess they didn't want the Headshrinkers to job again coming off the loss, the tag title loss. And they wanted to still keep them fairly strong. And, of course, you didn't want to have IRS and Bigelow lose right off the bat. So, you know, you have Asuka come in, act like the idiot, and starts hitting everyone. So, I mean, it's fine. What are you going to do?
Right.
It's an opener. It didn't mean much. The match itself is fine. So I'm okay with it here. I mean, yeah, of course, clean finishes are always preferred. But in this case, I'm cool with it.
One of my most recent lasting memories of this show is one of the few times that you actually came to visit me.
Mm-hmm.
And I was watching this show for us to prepare doing the written review, which, of course, as I mentioned, please follow along with us tonight on bigelow34.proboards.com. And you were sitting on my couch.
P.S. Your cunt is in the sink.
Well, I'll tell you something. After eating that chili, it's going to be more than something in my sink. Yes, I remember you. You looked a little peaked while I was watching this show. Didn't you have like you had some hallucinogenic dream about Razor Ramon or something going on while you were?
That's when I was working full time here in Rhode Island, but I was coming back mm-hmm. there to help out with the NFL Network preseason stuff, which I had done on my yep. previous job. And I was just, yep. I was driving down there Friday after work and working overnight and then crashing on your couch and going back. Yeah, I was working like crazy hours. So I was, I was definitely out of it watching that show that day. I just needed to crash big time.
Yes. But yeah, I remember you went to Bobby Valentine's, which the first one here in Stamford, two towns south of us, of me. And I believe you said
what
you had some...
kind of disgusting, despicable.
Well, if you would have had this chili, you would have said the same thing. And yes, I remember I was watching our next match actually, and you were like in some kind of strange haze. But that's my one of my lasting memories of watching this show. But yeah, so there's your opener, and nothing fancy, nothing great, decent little tag match to get the show started. Crowd looked like they were excited anyway, so you probably could have had nothing going on in the ring, and probably would have gotten away with it. Our next match, I guess you could say that probably fits it perfectly. Our next match is one that gets you very excited because it's, again, one of your favorite stars of the mid-90s. And that is your World Wrestling Federation Women's Champion. Excuse me. The exciting and vivacious Alundra Blaze. And she took on...
Bull Naka 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 No.
Yes. quite the opposite of what she looked like. Excuse me. Still trying to kick this cold. My apologies. A World Wrestling Federation Women's Championship match. The first time in SummerSlam history we have a women's title match. And these two were actually... having a pretty decent feud, right? Throughout the last couple months?
Yeah, Luna couldn't get the job done herself against Alundra Blaze, who, of course, as we detailed, WrestleMania 10 was the women's champion. So she brought in Bull Nakano from Japan, or Bull Nakano. I'm doing the Savage version of it.
Nakano!
Bull Nakano! So they, they had a pretty good feud. Bull, you know, jumped Alundra, and then she ran through some competition on Raw, a few different ladies that they brought in. And they were built up for this show here. So going in, I think probably amongst the smart community, they knew what was coming. Us fans at home that weren't really up to speed on the Japanese women's scene probably weren't expecting too much. But Bull Nakano is an awesome, awesome women's wrestler. And yes. Alundra, you know, Medusa could hang with her for sure. And this is a very, very good match. It's up there, definitely, as one of the greatest WWF women's pay-per-view matches ever. We both gave it a 3.5. Bull really beats the crap out of her, but Alundra hangs in and eventually hits her with a nice, stiff German suplex into a bridge. 8 minutes they gave them, and it was exciting. It was a good match. I really liked it. And Alundra defends her title. Good, solid defense, but this feud definitely is far from over. And, what did you think? Did you gravitate to Bull? I know she's physically your kind of woman, so.
And I love the hairstyle too. Yes. At the time, yeah, because, you know, the women's division had been kind of out of it for a few years, and we were not ready for the quote unquote word diva had not been in the vernacular yet. So
right.
we were still looking for women's matches that had some teeth to them. So I liked Bull Nakano because I think it was nice to see this beauty, you know, and I knew who Alundra Blaze was, obviously, because I knew her as Medusa Michelli in WCW. So I knew she was a good wrestler, but it was good to make sure that they would bring in some good talent on the other side. And, you know, and Vince was still in that Federation philosophy of big monster heels, and didn't matter whether men or women. She was definitely a force to be reckoned with. So I gravitated to her in the sense that it was good to have Alundra Blaze have a solid opponent. And not just a big, you know, big, fat, right, crazy-looking monster. She could really move. She was, you know, in a weird way, her moveset kind of reminded me of a female Bigelow in some ways. She moved really smoothly in the ring for a big woman. And, Alundra was a solid foil for her.
And Bull's finisher also was impressive. It was a top rope leg drop. So she could move and she could fly a little bit. And, I always enjoyed this feud. And, you know, it's funny because we've talked about it over the last couple years with the shows starting at WrestleMania 9, but Luna Vachon, kind of an underrated promo. When I was watching those Raws from mid-93, early 93, she was actually very good getting her points across, so not a bad little mouthpiece for Bull as well. She's got the natural Luna heat with her as well to really, you know, obviously you don't need much during this time. If you were Japanese, you were a heel, so that was more than enough. And of course, she had the great Orient Express music, so that added to it. But The feud was solid, but the match is very good. And it shows that maybe they actually were going to be serious about women's wrestling this time around.
Yeah, and it would last for a while. A little bit, anyway. So our first real good match of the night, and I was feeling good. Again, I didn't watch this. I was looking forward to this show after I was reading it in the magazines. And when it came to my Blockbuster, I rented it immediately and was looking forward to the show, and after these first couple matches, I thought, wow, this actually turned out to be a pretty good show. I wish I had watched it live. And our next match continues the high energy. No, not the tag team. Although you would love that. We have our second championship match. It is for the World Wrestling Federation Intercontinental Championship. Your champion.
I can't believe the whole thing!
I can't either, Art. Your champion, Big Daddy Cool, Diesel.
Yes.
Who, of course, won the title back in April against Razor Ramon.
Hey, I may have the winner.
Are you going to pick him to win it, Art? Are you going to remember? let's hope you remember.
I like the other guy to win.
Yeah. I thought you picked the other guy. Oh, wait, I did. Never mind. So, there you go. The Click members collide.
I don't know, man. I don't know. She's just acting real funky.
Oh, good Lord. You know, we got a couple years before we have to deal with that. So, Big Daddy Cool defending his Intercontinental Championship against Razor Ramon. Now, going back to the style of cheap pops, Razor Ramon would have, of course, Sean would be in Diesel's corner. Yes. Sean getting his summer vacation as a reward for staying and putting on an awesome match.
He's actually back in the ring at this point now.
Was he back? Okay, I wasn't sure if it was until September.
He made his return. Well, no, because they won the tag titles, obviously.
Oh, that's right. Yes,
and
of course.
Let me just double check. I'm pretty sure it was August 1st, if I remember that date correctly. He made his return to the ring on Raw, and he fought Razor Ramon in a WrestleMania rematch. Let me just confirm. Yes, August 1st. Him and Razor had a 23-minute match on Raw.
Wow.
And Sean won with a roll-up after Diesel interfered. So that's actually on the Hits from the Heartbreak Kid. I think that must be an old tape, right? That's not the one of the DVDs,
yeah.
Is it?
No. That's definitely an old tape.
And
yeah.
It's actually on the Best of Raw Seasons 1 and 2 as well. So.
Really? That 23-minute match?
Yeah.
Really?
Yep.
Wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I remember it's a really good match. It was his first match since WrestleMania.
Oh, I'll have to find that. That set's got to be cheap now. I'll have to take a look.
What the hell is this shit? What, chocolate or something?
Good Lord. What a mess. For those that don't know, well, you know what? I'm going to make you guess who that is. You probably know anyway.
No, they know. Who doesn't know that?
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. That, of course, is Jake the Snake from Beyond the Mat, where he's a drooling vegetable in the hotel room, doped high on more crack than you could possibly purchase. Now, two things stick out of this from the start for this match before we get to the match itself, which I liked a lot, as did you. Number one, the cheap pop. Sean is in Diesel's corner, and in Razor's corner is former Chicago Bears great, future NFL Hall of Famer, the late, great Sweetness, Walter Payton. And of course, cheap pop for the Chi-Town crowd. Oh, and incidentally, before we move on, the day before this show, they had that charity softball game between WWF superstars and the Chicago sports media, you know, newspaper writers, radio guys. Probably Mancow probably played in that game.
Yeah, I think Mancow was the guy running that team against Lawler, I think.
Yep. And that's when you got to see the other talent of the Macho Man, because he cranked a monster shot home run in that game. So you catch it if you have the Coliseum video, which I do. They mention it somewhere in the show. I don't remember where, but they do talk about it. I don't know if they mentioned it. Do you remember them mentioning it live? They probably did, right?
I think they show clips of it, actually, on the show.
Yeah. Okay, they do it on the Coliseum video as well. Anyway, so Walter Payton, Chicago legend, number 34, Sweetness, is in Razor's corner. The other thing, now, you and I have been Federation fans. We've been company men for a long time. And they have been the masters of merchandise production. There have not been many ugly things.
No, I wouldn't say that. There's been a decent amount of ugly things.
A decent amount, but not many since the Attitude Era. But the mid '90s had their share of failed experiments, and one of them, and you and I each had a friend, or in your case, a relative, who purchased it. On this night, they debuted a brand new Razor Ramon T-shirt. It was this gaudy looking banana yellow shirt with a huge half of his face on the front of it. It was the ugliest thing I think I'd ever seen in my life.
Yeah, it was pretty grotesque.
It probably goes down as one of the five worst T-shirts the company ever made. But again, yes, I know, and you made the point, and overall the point makes sense. It was, you know, the bright colored era of the new generation. So the color thing is not the problem. The design and the scheme was just a disaster. You know, remember Razor wore banana yellow tights, so. You know, it made sense. The shirt itself, though, was a colossal piece of crap. And my friend Gary, who liked Razor, and one Friday night, I was just starting my senior year in college, and it was Friday night, I was getting out of class, him and I were going to go to the movies and hang out, and he pulls up in front of my house, and I look at him, I go, I can't believe you did it. He goes, what? I can't believe you actually. And how much were the T-shirts then? Were they 20?
Yeah, probably around there.
$20. I said, you actually wasted $20 on that? He goes, what? I thought you know I liked Razor. I'm like, I know, dude, but seriously? What are you afraid of getting pulled? What are you afraid of if your car breaks down, you don't need to light flares? You could just wave in the middle of the road? I ripped the shit out. I mean, a guy is one of my dearest friends when I was a kid and when I was in college and high school, but that was one of the ugliest pieces of shit I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, it was an odd design for sure.
Yes. And as mentioned, your cousin owned one as well. Mm-hmm. Poor guy. Vinny. Do I know Vinny? Is Vinny the
man you affectionately call Giambi?
Giambi. Ah, Giambi, yes. Good man. Bad shirt, good man. All right. There's your match. And the match itself, two click guys. You're going to expect a colossally great match. And it was.
Did you mention? I know you were teasing it. The guy in Razor's Corner?
Yeah, I said Walter Payton. Yeah.
Okay, I wasn't sure if you finished.
Yep, and his son. Yeah, Walter's son was there too.
Yep. Jarrett
Payton.
Right?
Was his kid there too? Yeah, Jarrett Payton. Who would end up going to. Where did he go to college?
Not sure about that. I know he made the NFL. He played for the Titans for a while.
Yeah,
where did he go to school? I forget where else he ended up, but.
I don't know if he went to
see. He comes to the ring. He comes to the ring at the end. But Walter, yeah. I think it was a good piece of celebrity usage here. Obviously, Walter Payton was a god in Chicago.
Yes.
And it was good to. I mean, Razor didn't really need the additional pops anyway, but it was cool the way they had built Sean as being this troublemaker through all these, you know, over the past few months. And obviously, Brett needed someone to back him up against Diesel and Sean, and now Razor does the same. So I thought it was a good touch. Payton doesn't get too involved to where it's like overbearing or obnoxious. He just chases Sean around a couple times, and I thought it was fine. I thought it was a good piece of usage of celebrities.
Yeah, I agree. Now it's going to kill me. I have to look it up. I'll have to look it up during our break. Cause I got to, he went to his father, Walter went to Jackson State, probably one of the greatest, black college players of all time. But I don't think his kid went, I think Jarrett went to a kind of more high profile school. I'll have to look it up. Anyway, the match is very good. And
he went to Miami.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, so he definitely went to more high profile school. Okay.
Then he was undrafted. He played in the Canadian Football League. And then was signed by the Titans, where he played, looks like for a couple years, and now he's still in. Well, he went back to the Canadian League, and now he's in the Indoor Football League.
Oh, okay.
So more than you ever needed to know about Jarrett Payton.
About Jarrett Payton. Now I just want to know what school he went to, but that's good. Now, the one thing about this match I like is that a lot of times when you talk about the talent of the clique, you usually think of Sean as the central piece, mm-hmm. and he wrestles everybody else. But this is the first time you actually get to see the other two guys, the other big dudes, have a really good match. Again, usually Sean dictates the tempo against the other guys. But here we get to see the two big guys, Razor and Diesel. And I thought they put on a tremendous match. You know, Razor, it's Making an analysis like this is kind of sad, considering what's going on in his life now. But Scott Hall, definitely, when he really didn't have his head up his ass, was one of the best in-ring guys of this four or five-year run.
No, definitely.
When he really wanted to get the job done, the guy put on great matches. And what I loved here is he actually, for a guy who was, what, 275 pounds,
mm-hmm.
actually played a good small guy in this match.
Yep.
You know, he played the good small guy, which is great. Now, Diesel was the big man, and he let Diesel dictate the tempo.
Yeah, he's a great great talent. In ring, on the mic, character-wise, was tremendous. And obviously, we'll detail his spiral as we go along and into what he's mm-hmm. become. But, yeah, here he was in his prime as far as being a top-level character goes. And he was very, very over throughout this whole summer, throughout this whole feud. Mm-hmm. And it's been a good feud. Razor and Sean have been battling since December. Diesel got in the mix, stole his title, and now Razor gets revenge. They have a good 15-minute match. Lots of action, a lot of activity around ringside, a lot of heat, a lot of excitement. And, of course, the most important part outside of Razor Ramon regaining his title is, of course, how the match ends. And that's when Shawn Michaels comes in the ring. Diesel holds Razor up. Razor ducks, and Shawn super kicks Diesel.
Mm-hmm.
For now, it looks like a little bit of miscommunication between the new tag team champions, but as we will see over the next few months, things would start to degenerate a little bit more.
No pun intended.
Yes.
But yes, so Razor Ramon, once again, World Wrestling Federation Intercontinental Champion, second time. And Diesel is a little pissed, just a little. But it might have been just an accident. Just mm-hmm. an accident. Accidents happen. For now. We'll get more into it. That's a good match. Let me check our good man, the Broham, Graham Cawthon. That match is on nothing. That match is not on anything. In fact, this show, there's only one match that's on anything.
Right.
And we all know what match that is, but we'll get to that in a minute. So there it is. Razor Ramon is your new World Wrestling Federation Intercontinental Champion. Second time for him. And but a good match. I suggest looking for it. It's one of the best. If you have the Coliseum video as I have, or if you have the you have it right off the pay per view, right?
Yep.
Your copy. So if you have that, you taped it right off TV like he did, like Justin did, or if you have the little cooler compilation. It's a match, definitely, if you've never seen, definitely watch. It's one of the unheralded matches of that show. A lot of people think this is a one-match show. It certainly is not. Certainly is not. And this match is that we just watched, we talked about a great women's match, and also this match. Diesel and Razor put on a great match here. One you should definitely check out if you can find it. See if it's on YouTube or... Our next match... I'm looking forward to this because I want you to... This is all you, my friend.
Oh, yes.
The build for this one is just so colossally hysterical.
I love this.
I'm not
going
to take...
I love this whole thing.
I'm not stealing your thunder. I'm letting you... This is all yours. Our match...
What kind of disgusting, despicable lack of respect is that Billy What's-His-Name show booking a match for the total package Lex Luger and Super Brawl? Super Saturday? What is it? I don't even know what it's called. What is it called?
Super Brawl Saturday.
Super Brawl Saturday? Can he afford to pay me to wrestle around? I don't know. I'm one of the biggest legends and stars ever in this. God! And you teach with your tooth part two, Billy? And you book a match with me against Ryan Killings? Look at me. I'm a total package. I will rip him apart. I'm pissed now.
Well, you would end up being pissed big time at the end here. Our match is Lex Luger, your aforementioned total package, taking on
the motherfucking Native American, Tatanka.
Ladies and gentlemen, as always, our Argentinian freedom fighter, El Gigante.
This is all I have to say about this fucking prick. He gets the chance to beat the Ludovic Borga, and he fucking blows it on the superstars and ends his streak and gets hit with the chair.
Pretty much. Now, where were you, El Gigante, at Super Brawl Saturday?
At Super Brawl Saturday, I was supposed to fight Ron Killings, but the Lex Lugas took my spot. His shirt was too tight, and mine was too big.
Lex Lugas?
Lex Lugas, yes.
He sounds like a librarian.
He is, a librarian of my asshole.
Hey, earlier tonight I was talking with our good friend Dr. G, and we were watching...
The Dr. G's. We don't care about him.
We were watching a match from Capital Combat 90, and there you were in your big Super V vest there.
The El Gigante was there.
You looked really great. You looked really great, I have to say.
I always look good, you son of a bitch, you old piece of shit. I saw a picture of you tonight. You were singing some kind of song. Was that the,
yes,
the Justin Bieber you were singing?
Yes. No, I don't remember what that was, but that was for that was the song for our good friend the Lithuanian lover boy or whatever the hell we call the Liverpool lover boy.
You look like you were in the midst of going down on the Rotellas.
All right, go back to your
goodbye.
To your fighting.
Goodbye.
Go back to fighting freedom in Buenos Aires. Okay, there you go. Anyway, okay. Tatanka is who, of course, he's talking about anytime we mention Ludwig Borga. Taking on the total package Lex Luger. You're wondering, why are two baby faces fighting each other? Well, why don't you, my friend, paint the lovely picture for us?
Okay. Over the summer, in June, Ted DiBiase comes out, starts talking about the fact that he had signed Lex Luger to join his corporation. Now, not a lot of people believed it at first. No one thought Lex Luger would sell out to Ted DiBiase, but he kept pushing the issue and hinting at it, and on 7/18, Luger actually earned an IC title match with Diesel. And during the match, Ted DiBiase was at ringside rooting him on. They would go to a double DQ, and DiBiase was very upset that Luger didn't win the title, kind of stomping around. Later in that show, he had a little face-off with Tatanka at ringside, and they were arguing, Tatanka saying he wasn't sure, he didn't know if Luger really would have sold out, and he called out DiBiase, and DiBiase said, oh yeah, well, I bet you can't even beat Nikolai Volkov, and we'll put $10,000 on the line. And one of my favorite, and my little inner circle of friends' favorite Raw moments, where Tatanka repeatedly keeps saying, yeah, well, I'll take that bet. Yeah, I'll take that bet. I'll take that bet. He says like four times in the span of like 40 seconds. That was one of the things we always repeated over and over. So, of course, the next week, Tatanka would defeat Nikolai in the $10,000 challenge. And as the weeks went on, Tatanka started to kind of believe the rumors, and he would kept questioning Luger, kept calling him out, saying that he had sold out to DiBiase, and Luger kept denying it. He said he did have a meeting with Ted DiBiase, but that he did not sign a deal. And DiBiase kept saying, yes, yes, he's mine. He's all mine. He's part of the corporation. Tatanka kept arguing about it. So Luger says, fine, you know what? Let's have a match at SummerSlam, me and you. Two guys that had been prepped as good friends since 1993. We're going to face off here to... I'm not sure what they were looking to prove, Luger.
Yeah, I don't either.
Somehow defeating him was going to prove he wasn't lying. But and, of course, it was hinted that DiBiase would be with Luger here. Now, many of you know the fallout from the match, obviously, and it was telegraphed a million ways from Sunday, and that is Ted DiBiase ended up hooking up with Tatanka. It was Tatanka who had sold out all along, and DiBiase helps him defeat Luger by distracting him and throwing some money at him, or handing him a bag of money, and Tatanka rolls him up, and then they kind of look at Luger with the money, and then they attack him, and Tatanka now becomes a heel. But and the funniest bit of all this is earlier in the show, they had the little hotline segments where they'd be backstage and some of the wrestlers would be on the hotline. And I can't remember if it was DiBiase that was being interviewed or if it was Luger or Tatanka. Do I have it in here?
So I
think it was this Pettengill asking fans if... Oh, yeah. Was it...
It was either at SummerSlam.
Hang on. Okay. Okay, there were two times it happened. The first time was actually in the SummerSlam Sunday Night Slam show. Remember, we watched this as well, where Vince and Jerry Lawler were taking live calls.
Yes. Yep.
And a fan called in and said he thought Tatanka sold out, and Vince kind of cut him off and hung up on him. And that whole show was tremendous. It's all the loser fans with hang-ups and crank calls. You could tell they were way in over their heads. And then earlier on this show, Todd Pengill's asking different fans, like, you know, who do you think? Do you think Luger sold out or not? And one guy goes, I think Tatanka sold out, and they quickly talk over him and cut him off. it was pretty funny. So 6 minutes, quick match here. Tatanka wins, is now a heel. Now, and I want to know what your thoughts on Tatanka turning heel are. Do you think it could have worked if they went the route we've talked about before? If he, I guess it wasn't as big at this point, but if he became kind of the money-hungry casino kind of Indian with the suit, or I shouldn't say Indian, Native American in the suit, you know, saying that that the white man had stole his land and he was coming for revenge and he was a businessman looking, you know, if he did that kind of thing instead of just, he ended up just keeping the same exact look and everything else and just was a heel now.
Yeah, the only difference really was his color started to get a little darker.
Yeah,
he would start wearing like
dark brown,
yeah, darker and brown and black and yeah, instead of the lighter brown and he. And that kind of thing. But I think that would have been funny. He walked around with like a suit and that, and he keeps his hair,
yeah.
But he walks around in a suit and a briefcase and,
yeah,
you know, looking sleazy and yeah, why not? I mean, you got to totally do a 180. All of a sudden he's just the same,
basically.
You know, and then he ended up becoming a big loser after this. But I mean, that's neither here nor there. But,
well, as we see, unfortunately, he just, like other guys will see as we go along in these shows, once they're pretty good faces because they can sell and make good comebacks. But when they turn heel, it's just not the same because they don't have the offense to carry the matches.
Right. No, they don't. They don't. The match is kind of, it's all right. Not great. These two actually would have had a better match a year and a half earlier at King of the Ring. When Luger was the heel and dictating the tempo for some weird reason, the match was actually better.
Well, this match, they don't give him a lot of time here. I mean, this is all about the storyline.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, I understood the heel turn, you know, it seemed like right after WrestleMania 9, Tatanka's face character quickly got stale. Mm-hmm. It was like almost immediately. So this was probably long overdue anyway.
Yeah.
But it would have been nice to see, you know, like a different kind of sleazeball with a briefcase and, you know, going to different cities and saying, we're closing up a couple of schools to open up a casino and, you know, like sleazy things like that. I think that'd have been pretty cool. He could have been working with DiBiase as like his money man, you know, kind of like they could have had like this sleazy money grubbing thing going on. I think that would have been a good idea. I think it would have been a lot better than just turning him heel and just being some dude. You know, it's not like
the guy that they hoped DiBiase's heat would rub off on to help turn him heel.
Yeah. Well, You could slowly see over the next 6 months that, and this is, I don't know how to say this without insulting DiBiase because we love the Million Dollar Man, but it just, I don't know, just wasn't there. But we'll analyze that more as time progresses. But so the whole time I would love to have seen Lex Luger turn heel again. I think that would have been even better.
I almost feel like they should have went that way. It's almost they telegraphed it too much. They should have had Luger turn heel. I think he was better suited for it.
Yeah, because he's a disgusting sleazeball anyway.
Yeah.
So Tatanka is now firmly in the camp of the Million Dollar Company, Million Dollar Corporation, and Lex Luger looks like a fool again. So after two straight, so we're batting about 500 so far. We've got two really good title matches and then two kind of flat average matches. So before we move on to the next flat, we actually have, and this show continues to go up and down anyway as we move ahead. But right now we'll take a break and kind of chomp on that heel turn and talk to our good friends, the announcer and the champ, from WrestleChat.net. Because
the promotional considerations have been paid for by these followings.
How many pro wrestling news websites do you visit to get your daily news? 3, 4, maybe 5? Do yourself a favor and make that number 1. WrestleChat.net, the only professional wrestling news site that brings you all wrestling news all day long, and is home of the critically acclaimed Still Real to Us podcast, starring former CZW ROH and ECW announcer Eric Gargiulo
and the champs, Jeff Pex.
That's WrestleChat.net. WrestleChat, it's where it's at.
Jeff's pecs. sounds like a gym. Let's go check out Jeff's pecs.
Shut up, you asshole. Go back and sing the Beebus.
the Beebus. And Lex Lucas. WrestleChat.net is your home for everything pro wrestling. Of course, our weekly news and notes segment on our Cornucopia Fun and Games headline show is brought to you by our good friends there. Everything WWE, TNA, and some UFC as well. Of course, the champ and the announcer there with their podcast. And, of course, you can link onto ours. Right on the right side of the page is the PTB Gnome, El Gigante's pet. Click on it, and you'll go right to our Podbean page and hop right on with us. So go to WrestleChat.net. It is your home for everything pro wrestling.
And before we do move on, we should take a moment to wish our good, dear, longtime, close, personal friend, the Liverpool lover boy himself, Matt Rotella, a happy, happy birthday.
Yes. I forgot it's November. Yes, it is his birthday. He still looks like a 9-year-old with glued-on hair, but that's okay. I did not see him today. I had the day off, but I'm sure was swearing up.
Consider yourself one day luckier if you didn't see him.
Yeah, exactly.
I have to deal with him twice later tonight.
You do, huh? Oof. Oh, that's right. He is going yes, for those of you who don't know, of course, we are big college hoop fans here on the Place to Be podcast. And you, my friend, later this evening are going to your first Friar game of the year.
Yep, I'll see him there. And then we are going to celebrate his birthday at Trinity Brew House down in Providence.
Ah, the Brew House right across the street from the Dunk. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, only him, though. He schedules the party for like 6 hours after the game's going to end. The game's at 2 o'clock, but for some reason we're going across the street to the bar at 9:30. So only him.
What's he going to do? What's he going to do? Jog up and down the escalators at the mall?
The George Scott of booking plans here.
Well, I get to see him back-to-back nights next week, because we're actually going to see the Friars on Monday at the arena at Harbor Yard against Fairfield. And then the next night we'll be back because, as you know, your humble correspondents will be live for WWE programming next week. My PIC and my friendly mortal enemy, Rob Houston, heading to Boston Monday night for Raw. You'll see the return of the great Mick Foley. And the Liverpool Loverboy and I will be Tuesday night back at the arena at Harbor Yard for SmackDown. So, of course, we will give you a full report on that Wednesday night on our headline show, Cornucopia of Fun and Games. But that's Wednesday. Let's talk back to tonight. Back to the United Center in Chicago for SummerSlam 1994. Like I said, we batted about 500 so far this tonight. We've got two really good matches, both title matches, and two kind of flat average matches. We move on to our next match, which is really... Ugh. What is going on here? This is Vince. I don't think if he was in prison now after if he was convicted of the steroids or whatever and he was in jail, this match would never have happened. But this is Vince. This is Vince's handprints. Jeff Jarrett. Of course, your cousin's number one guy. Taking on there he is.
Get that fat ass of the purple out there and tell him to rap. Then get him back to his cage.
That's right. Mabel, one-third of the new edition. He's our candy fat ass.
Yes.
And this match is just, I mean, this match is just so, so bad.
And there's really not much of a build here. Obviously, like we talked about, they wanted to keep Mabel. They liked him as a big, happy face. So with Mo out, they wanted to kind of keep him in the singles spotlight. Jeff Jarrett really didn't have much going on at all here. And so the week before the show, they had him have a little confrontation in the aisle on Raw, and Jarrett kind of avoided him. They built it up as country versus rap. Because obviously these two men completely epitomize the two genres.
Of course, absolutely. Not exactly Mr. Perfect versus the No Limit Soldiers, that's for sure.
No, this is the country megastar versus the king of the New Jack Swing, Mabel.
Lovely. New Edition versus, Conway Twitty?
Yes, Conway Twitty.
Trying to think of some when bad country guy of the 80s.
When we talk to Stevie Richards next time, I want to see why he didn't use that name instead. The King of New Jack Swing, I think that would have been
the King of New Jack Swing, yes. Probably because he was working with New Jack in ECW, perhaps.
Yeah, but New Jack wasn't New Jack.
Well, yeah, that's true. That's true as
well.
He was
rap. He was hardcore. He wasn't New Jack Swing, man. New Jack Swing's Boyz II Men, New Edition.
Right.
Yep. What are those assholes' names?
Johnny Gill?
No.
R. Kelly?
No.
Bobby Brown?
What is it? We're just listening to him today. The guys, Color Me Bad.
Okay. Color Me Bad? I want to sex you up, Vanilla Ice.
Yeah, but there was another. Oh, no, there was another one I'm thinking of. Not Color Me Bad. Fucking A.
Crisscross?
No. Well, yeah, they're considered New Jack Swing as well. Yeah. Oh, this is going to drive me insane now. I got to try and find it.
You know what?
Melba DeVoe, that was definitely OPG. New Jack Swing. That's not what I'm thinking of, though, but that is definitely New Jack Swing.
Blackstreet? No.
No.
They
were kind of fringe swing.
Hmm.
They may technically be considered. I'm looking.
You know what? We'll have to save this for our return to.
Oh no! I'm
going to
find it right now. I'm looking through my playlist there.
We are going to have. We are folks. We are going to return to the time machine with our men Reesh and Jordan Duncan at some point to talk about early '90s New Jack Swing. So.
De La Soul. That's what I'm thinking of.
Oh God, De La Soul. Oh, yikes. Good Lord.
Don't you hate on De La Soul?
Is that like Rex in Effect?
No, that was.
Was a zoom 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 in
no,
a boom?
No, that
boom.
Was. Yeah, that wasn't them. That was
Commercial rap.
Yeah.
All right. Before we continue on deeper into this genre and start pulling out Casey and Joe or something. Yeah.
Mirror, mirror on the wall. Tell me, mirror, what is wrong? Can it be my daylight clothes or is it just my daylight song?
They need Oscar rapping that. All slow.
Yeah.
Is it just my De La Soul?
Yeah, because if you try to do it, that's going to be more like just my beatbox. Great. We're gonna get Facebook messages for this one.
Hey, you're the one who's talking jive, not me. I'm just talking about New Jack Swing. You're one step above the Rotella Silverback.
And from that comment, he's world heavyweight champion now. All right. Okay. Enough's enough. As much as I'd love to, as much as it's better to actually listen to this wonderful music than actually talk about this match,
we have to talk about these matches.
We have to talk about these matches. And this match is absolutely abysmal. So why don't we move on? Jeff Jarrett wins because Mabel goes for a butt drop and misses it. And then Jarrett lifts up like half his calf for the three count.
Yeah, I'm actually surprised that they had Mabel lose here. I mean, he lost to IRS in the first round of the tournament. And Jarrett didn't really seem destined to go anywhere at this point, so... I thought Mabel would pick up the win, honestly. I was a little shocked.
Well, if they're making such a big stink about giving him singles matches, you'd think he'd at least freaking win them.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
You know? Just weird. Anyway, let's move on. Because now we get down to the nitty-gritty. We get down to the centerpiece match. of this show. Clearly.
Who are you to doubt El Dandy?
Well, we're not doubting you, my friend, because you're up. So get in the ring.
This guy's a serious professional. Well,
he may be, but that's not who you're fighting tonight. Next up is indeed your World Wrestling Federation Championship match. And for the first time in 4 years, 5 years, actually. Oh, yeah. For the first time in 5 long years, we have a cage match.
Fat sloppy pig.
Well, that was the last show. He's not on the show.
Yeah, he was. He was in the opener.
Was he? Did he come out with the head shrinkers on? Oh, well. So for the first time,
hey, PTB Nation, it is now time for the Rob Houston Memorial Hacksaw Jim Duggan update.
As the sexual tones of Derek LaRue bring us in, the time has finally arrived where the Jim Duggan, now WCW, update is upon us. At this time, Hacksaw Jim Duggan had already made his WCW debut, defeating the great Tex Slazenger on the July 19th Saturday night taping. That was his official debut. On August 15th, on the WCW Pro taping, he teamed with Marcus Alexander Bagwell and the Patriot as they lost a tough match to Lord Steven Regal, Paul Orndorff, and Paul Roma, some of your favorites. And then, on 9/25, of course, taped August 16th, though, would air on 9/25, edition of the main event. He fought Lord Steven Regal, the TV champion, to a draw. And then he would tour Europe. He defeated Diamond Dallas Page on September 1st in Zurich, Switzerland. He would return to Wembley Stadium, defeat DDP there as well. Defeated DDP before that in Birmingham. This is all early September. Defeated DDP once again in Germany. Spielberg in Munich. He pinned DDP again. And again in Frankfurt. He's already continuing his winning ways as he finished off the tour in Dortmund, Germany on September 14th. To defeat DDP once again. Now, Jim Duggan will have a much more prolific month, but we'll save that for our next show. So for now, that is the Jim Duggan WCW update.
I don't do any tricks.
I wish you had and cut off that entire report. I'm glad we all know that DDP rebounded from that 15-match losing streak to eventually become WCW World Champion.
The boo-hoo Jim Duggan crew led by Scott Criscola.
Yeah, sorry. How'd he even be allowed out of the country? Wasn't he on a work visa? Wasn't he on wasn't he still serving some type of probation for the roach clips and the easy widers that were in his trunk with the Iron Sheik?
Yeah, he was the Goodwill Ambassador.
Oh, good Lord. Oh, yeah, there's a guy. Have him do speeches. Rather hear Oscar. Anyway, let's get back to two actual good wrestlers. Bret the Hitman Hart. No, Art, you were a great defensive lineman, but you never wrestled. Bret the Hitman Hart, your World Wrestling Federation heavyweight champion. Continuing the feud he was having with his younger, jealous brother, Owen. And, of course, Owen had a pretty good summer back in June in Baltimore in front of the Goodwill Ambassador, Art O'Donnell. Owen Hart won the King of the Ring. And that led him to this match, getting a world championship match against his brother inside of a steel cage.
And, of course, all of the Hart family at ringside here.
Yeah, this is where it reaches a zenith in terms of the family being on camera. I mean, like, everybody's
Diana
here.
Diana was there. The Anvil. I love that, too, because you have the main family members all sitting the front couple rows, and then the Anvil kind of slunk down behind them, kind of almost hiding in a way. But also in the front row, a returning superstar, this guy, we haven't seen him since the fall of 1992 when he was sent packing with the rest of the steroid monsters, And that is the British Bulldog, Davey Boy Smith, sporting a new look, of course, of the curly hair, and he has his little glasses on, and he was, as always, juiced to the gills, as you would expect out of the British Bulldog. So yes. he is sitting front row, of course, with his wife, Diana, and Anvil slouched down behind them, and of course, Bruce and Keith and the rest of the Good Time Gang are out there as well. So, so a lot of anticipation here, of course. This whole family feud had been building since November the year before, and had been awesome, really carrying them throughout 1994. And the anticipation for this match was very, very high. Yes. And Bret and Owen, of course, Owen had defeated him at WrestleMania, won the King of the Ring, and now the last piece of the puzzle is to defeat Bret Hart for the title. We've talked about this match before. What makes it special is that Owen's not looking to hurt Bret. He's not looking to beat him up, not looking to maim him. He just wants the title.
Yep, so just wants to win.
This whole cage match is very different than most cage matches. He's not looking, it's not brutal, it's not vicious. It's just, it's 32 minutes.
It's a cat and mouse game.
Yes, exactly. Of Owen trying to escape and Bret trying to keep him in there and trying to escape himself. So it's basically Owen trying to keep Bret down long enough so he can get out of the cage, get the title, and get the fuck out of there. So 32 yep. minutes these two guys are given, these two brothers, and they deliver another classic. Not quite as good as their WrestleMania 10 gem, but it's damn good.
Yeah, well, it's a different philosophy. And this has to be, as far as I can surmise in my head, the first singles match in pay-per-view history to go over half an hour. In WWE pay-per-view history to go over 30 minutes. I don't think we've had a 30-minute plus singles match on pay-per-view yet.
I don't know. Maybe someone can look that up for us.
Yeah, somebody look that up through all of our vaults. I don't think we've had a singles match in the Federation. We definitely have one in the Federation years. And I don't think we've had one in the 90s yet go
Savage
over half an hour.
Well, what was Hogan? Hogan Warriors, what, 20 minutes?
24.
Yeah.
Yeah, that one definitely didn't get to 30 minutes.
Hmm. That's a good question. How about Bret Shawn at Sorry Sir's 92?
Close. Close. I think that one was like 28
I'm
change.
Looking it up
Let's
right
take
now.
A look. Okay.
That was 26:42.
Yeah, I still don't think.
And how about Bret
I still
Bulldog?
Don't... Bret Bulldog, I don't believe was that close.
25:09.
Yeah.
Those
no,
are
I seriously
closest.
Don't. Yeah. So the first singles match on pay per view,
probably,
to go half an hour. WWE pay per view.
Oh,
don't
how
count...
about Warrior Savage? That was pretty long. It's 7. That was oh no, 20:46 only. Okay, yeah, you may be right for once.
Yeah, I don't think there's been a singles match over 30 minutes. Obviously, that'll get broken eventually. And I'm saying WWE pay-per-view. Obviously, the NWA. If you're talking about Ric Flair, I think at least for a year we're over 30 minutes.
Yes.
But yes, the psychology, and I don't know if two other guys would have pulled this off as well. The reason that the match at 10 at the Garden was so great was because of the chemistry these two had.
Yep.
And that's why I think similarly, this match works the same way. Bret understood the philosophy. He knew that Owen had already beaten him. So beating Bret, just beating him up was irrelevant.
Right.
He wanted to take what Bret cared about more than anything. And that was the title.
And what he felt he deserved, because he beat Bret on the night that Bret won the title. So he felt that he all along should have been the champion.
Yep. And then to make it even better, he actually took the title of King from his brother.
Yep.
So it just everything worked out perfectly for this match. And for those of you who probably are thinking to yourself, oh, so they weren't really fighting. Oh, this must be a boring 32 minutes. Not at all.
No. A lot of excitement.
Not at all. And the crowd was off the charts.
I mean, and it's not just them running around. I mean, they hit some stiff moves.
Yes.
And Owen hits a good pile driver, and they whip each other into the cage. I mean, they're trying to take each other out. Bret suplexes them into the ring off the top of the cage. That's a great move. There's some really good moves here. So it's not just them running around. But the point is that they're trying to escape, not trying to maim each other. And, of course, at the end, they're both climbing. it looked like Owen may have the lead. Brett catches up to him, kind of bangs him off the cage, and Owen's legs get hooked in the bars, and he tips backwards, is hanging from the cage, watching his dream slip away as Brett climbs down and wins the match.
Right.
Now, after that, we have a great aftermath as the Anvil, who, as we said, was kind of slinked behind Bulldog the whole match, jumps up, clotheslines Davey Boy and Diana over the railing to wipe them out. Then he hops in the cage, they padlock the door, and Anvil and Owen just beat the shit out of Brett in the ring.
Yep.
And then, in an awesome, awesome moment, the rest of the Hart brothers, Bruce and Keith and Smith and Dean and all the other ones, they all jump. Oh, not Dean, obviously. Dean had passed away.
Okay, not. That would have been awesome.
Who's the other one I'm thinking of? Smith?
Smith, Owen, Keith, Bruce.
I thought there was another guy in there. Maybe not. Whatever. Ross.
Ross.
So they all hop up in the cage and they're trying to get in, and Davey Boy's back up, and they're, you know, they're all climbing up, and Anvil and Owen are fighting them off, and finally they all get in the cage, and Anvil and Owen run off, and the Hart brothers all help Brett up. So as far as Bruce didn't turn heel on him too on his own, but yeah. So a really cool moment. Just watching all the Harts scale the cage as Owen and Anvil beat the crap out of Brett inside was just great. So obviously this feud is not over still, even though Brett retains his title. And really the whole package, just like the year before with the whole Brett Lawler doink stuff, another match where it's a great match surrounded by a great storyline package. And really, this should have ended the show.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no question about it. And the Chicago crowd was great.
Yep.
And you made a great point. You put a great line. That's one of my favorite lines you've ever written in any of our reviews. If you lifted this scenario up and dropped it in the middle of a saddle dome, the place would not have been a saddle. It would have been a roof. The place would have just gone absolutely ballistic.
Yep.
Boy, what a vision, huh? That would. I try and picture that in my mind, seeing Owen and Neidhart just creaming Brett.
Yep.
Kudos to Brett for selling that, because he got the crap kicked out of him.
Yep.
And you got Bulldog and all these brothers, and Stu's like directing traffic outside, and all these guys are crawling the cage. And I mean, if it was in Calgary, the place would have been a riot. There would have been a riot. Owen would have gotten.
It was awesome. It's
killed.
It's a great moment.
Yeah. It was the height of the Hart family in the company.
Yeah.
Not that it would go down from here, but there wouldn't be many more good moments like this. So a 4-star match. This one, you know, you can find in a myriad of places.
Oh yeah, it's everywhere.
I will give you the list now. It's on the 1994 year in review tape. It's on Off the Top Rope, which I have no idea what that is. It's on Bloodbath, which is that old steel cage compilation.
Yeah, one of the first comp sets they really started to put out.
Yeah, in early 04.
How much does he weigh?
About 250. Thanks, Art. Sorry, Art. I can't hear you, Art. It's a great way of Gorilla blowing him off. The history of the WWE title. Sorry, Art. The history of the WWE Championship compilation, that like book looking set. And then finally, it's on, of course, it's got to be on the Heart and Soul DVD. It's got to be. So that matches on 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 things, 5 compilations. And of course, it's on the DVD in the cooler, too. So that's it. That's SummerSlam. Hope you never mind.
So now tell me, what would you rather have end the show? This match coming up or this segment?
Hey, Hacksaw, have you seen Sapphire, baby?
No, I haven't, Dust, but we're all still looking for her.
Well, if I had my way, we would have a camera follow Duggan walking out of the Spectrum driveway out into the street to look for Sapphire, and then a bus hit him. And then we could put up the copyright. So thanks. Sorry. He's not with the company anymore. It's not my fault. All right. Unfortunately, fans, and you all know this, we are not done. Yeah, I'm glad you're laughing, Art, because I'm not. Obviously, with the last two vintage vaults, someone has been conspicuously absent. And, of course, that guy that has been conspicuously absent is The Undertaker, who we have not seen since my PIC's pay-per-view cherry popper, the 1994 Royal Rumble in Providence, when he was lifted through the rafters and right past our man Jim up into the netherworld. after the 15 heel beating he took with Yokozuna for the title.
Yakazuma. The big jab, brother.
Yeah. Why don't you...
That's a soundbite you're going to get.
Yeah. Why don't you paint the picture for us, my friend?
Okay.
And, tell everyone what was going on. Where was the dead man?
All right. So as far back as April, following WrestleMania 10, rumors began swirling that Undertaker had been sighted around the country. We'd get little vignettes each week. Various local American Joes claiming they saw the Undertaker. Maybe he was at a deli, at a construction site, in the supermarket. But no one could grab a hold of him to find out when he was coming back or what he was doing.
At a deli.
Over the summer.
Ham and cheese, please. Deli. It's crazy.
Over the summer, after Ted DiBiase had fired up his corporation, he claimed, in addition to Lex Luger, that he had also bought the Undertaker services. Of course, it was DiBiase that had originally brought him into the promotion, and he said he was able to reach him and he had the connection to him, and that was a nice little bit of continuity.
Yes.
And so, lo and behold, one week, DiBiase comes out with the Undertaker. Undertaker was back on TV, started wrestling shows, house shows, TV, and to the diehard fans, though, it was a little bit obvious that it wasn't quite the real Undertaker. It was a little bit shorter, a little bit fatter. For the rubes in the audience and a lot of fans, it was close enough to be believable. And of course, the announcers, all kind of played it up as well. Paul Bearer would start coming out, though, and saying it was bullshit. He said, there's no way DiBiase had bought Undertaker services. It's not true. Paul Bearer said, I'm in charge of the dead man, not you. So they would come out, and Paul Bearer came out, and he tried to woo the Undertaker back with the urn, and Undertaker instead bowed down on one knee to DiBiase's money, not the urn. So the build-up here is actually pretty good. As we'll see, the match doesn't really pay off. But during this time, the WWF decided to hire a special detective to help try and locate the Undertaker during this missing period. And, of course, that is comedic legend Leslie Nielsen.
Yes.
For weeks, I've been flying all over the world, tracking down every lead I could in my attempt to solve this mystery of the Undertaker. Every trail I followed led to another dead end. I don't know what it is, but I feel I'm onto something.
All right, fans, Ray Rougeau here. The Undertaker mystery is thickening. I want to start that over. I didn't like it.
There I was, heading poolside, trying to catch some rain. Sorry, Ray. The girls were feeling macho.
Macho, man. You're so big.
Easy now, girls. It's family entertainment here.
I have work to do. I was scanning around the globe for clues to the biggest mystery of our time. The sun was extremely bright.
If your deductive capabilities were a fraction of what you profess, this incorrigible caper would have been solved by now.
Thank you, son. Right kid. And he was right. After all this time, I'm still tormented by that one burning question. How can there be two Undertakers? Maybe one is corrupt like you. Police, arrest that man. I will solve this case at SummerSlam.
So, of course, Leslie Nielsen, one of his many roles is the Naked Gun. He was always kind of playing the gumshoe dopey cop. So, and with all the different puns and different little clips like that. So we get a bunch of those vignettes, and here he shows up with his longtime compadre in the movies, and that is, of course, George Kennedy. Mm-hmm. Of course, it was John F. Kennedy's brother, right? But
yes, precisely.
He was part
yeah.
of the family, though, wasn't he? Wasn't he one of them?
I don't think so.
You sure?
No. No. Why do you do this to me? First off,
you know your politics, and obviously you're of age to have lived through the Bay of Pigs and various
yeah.
things. So
yeah, exactly. Maybe. Yeah. Joe. His father. Yeah, Jack's father, Joe, and I bootlegged liquor in the 1920s. Yes.
His father, George Harris Kennedy, was a. Maybe not. I don't know why I thought he was. Like a relative.
First off, there's two things about that. There's two things about that vignette that we're.
Well, hang on. Before
disturbing.
We get back to the vignette, I do have a question for you. Can you tell us?
Yes.
What was George Kennedy's role like in Sergeant Bilko? Did you enjoy that role?
You know what? I liked him. Well, it was only a few one-line parts. I did enjoy him in Spartacus.
Okay.
And he was also in Charade with Cary Grant.
Now, how did you feel, though, when the Phil Silver show became Sergeant Bilko, or simply Bilko in reruns? Did you feel like that was a good changeover?
Well, I don't know. I started going away from it. I started watching Gunsmoke, and then I saw him with Betty Davis in Sweet Charlotte, and then, of course, in Harm's Way with John Wayne.
So you didn't always follow the Dumont Network at the time, then?
No, the Dumont. I kind of stuck along with the American Broadcasting Company.
Okay.
The Masters of the Rabbit Ears.
Fair enough.
Anyway, as for that vignette, two things about that vignette were incredibly disturbing. Maybe it was just the quality of the audio, but number one, it sounded like Ray Rougeau was saying that this Undertaker story is sickening, not thickening. And boy, were
the
we right.
The Undertaker story is sickening.
And then number two, I do love how Randy Savage turned into the Ron Jeremy of vignettes.
Yeah, we'll take him, to be honest, at that point.
That's the last thing we needed. Savage is getting riding some meaningless ring rat. But anyway.
Yeah, I'm not that big.
Yeah. So there you go. Leslie Nielsen there. Frank Drebin. That was his name on Police Squad. Looking for the Undertaker. I like how the Undertaker was at a construction site. Really? Really?
Yeah.
Was at a construction site. Yeah, of course.
And of course, we need to talk about the man who's playing the fake Undertaker, or Under Faker, as he's been come to be known as, and that is, of course, Lee, mm-hmm. who was a professional wrestler, mm-hmm. started in the Continental Wrestling Association, USWA, down in Memphis, worked Smoky Mountain. That's where he kind of hit the big time as far as being like a kind of an indie name, indie star. He's a guy you'd always see in PWI and all the other different magazines.
Right.
He was brought in here just to portray the fake Undertaker, so... After this, he's never actually seen again after this show. He returns to Smoky Mountain. Well, Brian Lee's seen again, but the Undertaker is not. He goes back to Smoky Mountain and eventually to ECW, and he will return one day to the WWF. We'll see that in a few years out. So,
yes. Yeah. So you're thinking to yourself, wow, what an amazing moment, you know? The real Taker and the faker Taker.
Now, you know what's funny? During this time, since we've already name-dropped him once, and my cousin Vinny and my other cousin Jared, his brother, they went to a house show around this time. And, of course, The Undertaker was billed. And this is why when I said the Rubes kind of didn't really get the storyline. They went with their parents to the show. I think it was the one at the musical theater that summer he was there. And they were all pissed off because they felt like they had, specifically their mom, I remember heard, really complaining about this, saying that they had been ripped off, that they said it was The Undertaker, and they had clearly had a fake one, and not really understanding the storyline, just thinking they were just screwing with people and saying it was The Undertaker and having this guy pretend to be him. So it was kind of like, it wasn't the best idea for some of these people, you know, thinking they were getting The Undertaker, and they weren't, so.
Right, exactly. But I don't know what's more offensive, me talking jive or you calling 60% of our audience rubes. But
I didn't say 60% of our audience. I said
the
majority of the WWF's audience. Our audience is 100% non-rube.
That is, okay, fair. But you wanted to clarify that, and maybe they understand jive, so they're multifaceted. But
oh, they understand jive, and they understand how racist it is.
Hey, we're all good. We're all silverbacks in the end.
Yeah, if they find out you're sitting there in blackface doing this, then you're really in trouble.
Yes, and tomorrow night you're going to see Matt, and he's going to have a shirt that says, I love silverbacks, so that's okay. yeah, and if he walks around the dunk wearing that shirt, then you can...
By the way, I'm definitely wearing the... I know I said I might wear it to Raw, but I'm definitely wearing the Obey shirt tomorrow night for his birthday.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. I think I'm wearing his shirt. I think I'm going to wear it to SmackDown. Yeah, this match is just – well, here's the problem. Number one, Brian Lee is about a foot shorter than Taker.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, you have to have these guys well, not these guys. Mark Calloway is Taker, and he can – you know, he originated the movements and everything. And Brian Lee has to try and mimic that.
Right.
Which just makes it just unwatchable crap. And fortunately, it only lasts 9 minutes. Taker, the real Taker, hits three tombstones,
mm-hmm.
and seals the deal.
Yeah.
There's really not much more to say.
No, 9 minutes of boredom. The only highlight is Paul Bearer coming out with him. Of course, Taker, the real Taker, has got his new look at his purple on instead of gray.
I love the purple. Yeah, I love the purple.
And Paul Bearer has this diesel urn that he carries out.
I know, it's like the Cadillac of urns.
And he comes out, he opens it, and this big light shoots out, and he's turning it all over the arena, and then Taker walks out. So Taker's back after his vacation, much-needed vacation, and the fake Undertaker is never seen or really talked about again, honestly, until years later when the historical kind of vault stuff opened up, and they started to talk about their history more.
Yes.
For a while, we really don't hear much about the fake Undertaker. So the real Undertaker moves on, continuing on his revenge list, as we'll see at our next show. But unfortunately, for the second pay-per-view in a row, we really end with kind of a blah match after a pretty good show. As you said, this one was very up and down. To me, we ended up both settling it with a B.
Yeah.
You know, when you look at the match grades and the matches, you may say, oh, is this really a B? But it's the title matches that delivered and the ancillary matches didn't. And the main event was the main event, whatever. I mean, yeah, the end of the show on a kind of a blah note and the match sucks. But to me, the cage match, the IC and the women's match all carry the show and the crowd and the excitement and the look of it as well. So, and honestly, it was the good matches that were the longer ones. The other ones were all pretty short. You know, Bret and Owen was 30 minutes. Razor Diesel was 15, and Alundra Bull was 8. So I mean, you know, that was a good chunk of time. And even Tatanka Luger, it wasn't really that bad, and it was a pretty good storyline carrying on as well. So, and then the other matches was kind of there. So overall, yeah. I always enjoyed the show. I like the show. It has good good memories. Another nostalgic one. So I'm curious to see what the feedback is when we get to it in a minute. So what are your final thoughts on it?
Again, it's an up and down show, and anytime I throw it in, when after the awesome Bret Owen match and the after match, and then I watch the Leslie Nielsen vignette, and then I pop the tape, put it back on the shelf, and watch something else. I don't bother watching the rest. There's no need to. And if you are a fan, we recommend the show to watch. Again, we don't tell people what to watch or what not to watch, but if you want to save yourself 15 minutes of your life to do something else, pop the tape or turn off the DVD after Bret and Owen. There's nothing to watch after that. The matches in the middle, really, I mean, Jarrett and Mabel, you can kind of buzz through. But the matches you definitely want to watch are Razor Diesel, Alondra, Bull Nagano, and Bret Owen. Really is the backbone of the show.
Bull Nagano.
Nagano! And obviously, you know, take a deep breath and say a prayer for, of course, the Macho Man Randy Savage as we bid farewell to one of our favorites. It's gonna be tough, man. It's one of our favorites. Many great matches. Many great matches. We already gave you his record at WrestleMania 10. So, all right. Why don't we hop into the feedback? Because as usual, we have our well spoken and well versed, loyal and smart PTB Nation and their excellent comments. I'll buzz the two quick ones, and then I'll do my fellow Laker fan.
Okay.
Matt Davis says, have you finds Undertaker yet? Yes, we did, unfortunately. Nick German says, fool y'all, Tatanka.
Fool
did he really say that?
Fool
ya ma. Yeah. All right. Let's get down to the meat and potatoes. Fellow Laker fan, Corey Ferreira says, WWF debuts the new United Center, the fortress of the late 90s NBA. That is true. I don't think one arena was on TV more for the next 5 years than this building was, for the most part. Overall, the show is not good. Okay? The opening tag match is nothing special, but we get the return of the Million Dollar Man on pay-per-view and the start of his stable of heels who play a big role in the next year. Alundra Blazing Bull, Naka Naka No, in my opinion, might be one of the better female rivalries in WWF E history, considering the amount of matches they had during the era. That's true. The match is nothing much. The match is nothing much at all. Razor versus Diesel. Razor wins the strap back from Big Daddy Cool. Despite losing the IC title, Nash's stock would rise to the top by the fall. The Peyton HBK stuff is pretty good. Tatank versus Luger, nothing
Badonka.
At all. Tatank versus Luger, nothing at all. Look how far Luger has fallen from main eventing SummerSlam of 93 to middle of the card in 94. Double J and Mabel is a dud. The Mabel rise continues. Now the crown jewel of the night, the greatest cage match of all time. The WWF champion Bret Hart, the Hitman, and the 1994 King of the Ring, the King of Hearts, Owen Hart, go for 32 minutes of pure wrestling, and it's awesome. It deserves the 5-star rating, and it was given from Dave Meltzer.
You and I might need to rewatch that. I think we might be rating it a little bit lower than it deserves.
A little bit low, you think?
I think so.
Interesting. Okay. Might be right. Both matches they had in 1994 were true classics in WWF history. The return of The Undertaker to face The Underfaker, or as me and my friend called him, The Underfaker. Okay. The match is not good at all, but it gives us the staple for The Undertaker entrance as we know it today.
That's true as well, because to this point, we didn't really have the lights going out. And, you know, he had the entrance, but this has brought it closer to what we know.
Yeah, it does. Yes, you're right. I have to say the Leslie Nielsen promos of him looking for The Undertaker to build this match are pretty funny. Also, this match is the birth for The Undertaker Million Dollar Man feud for the coming months. Ugh. Overall, SummerSlam 1994 is a meh show. Some average in ring work, some poor, and a standout match. What a way to open the home of his airness. That is true.
Yeah, Pablo Picasso, Mr. Greenhouse, who has a new assignment that we can talk about off air. Bret Owen in a cage is a match that I can watch over and over again. Watching live on pay-per-view, I remember being on the edge of my seat the entire match. The return of Davey Boy Smith was a great surprise. Razor versus Diesel was awesome. I liked Walter Payton in a Razor's Corner. If Todd Pengill referred to Walter Payton as sweetness one more time, I may have thrown a brick through my TV. Luger versus Tatanka was eh. I liked the Tatanka heel turn. IRS and Bam Bam versus the Headshrinkers was a good opener. Would have been better if HBK and Diesel hadn't beaten the Shrinkers for the tag titles the night before. I'm sure this is around the time that Sean and Nash started using their stroke around the company. Especially Sean. Now the clusterfuck note is Undertaker versus Underfaker. I love the storyline and the vignettes with Leslie Nielsen, but the match is horrible. Brian Lee did one hell of a job pulling off the gimmick, but Mark Calaway pulls it off better. One of the better SummerSlams with an awesome Chi-Town crowd.
That's good. We have conflicting opinions there.
Mm-hmm.
Jay Hanchy says, SummerSlam 1994 came to the Chicago's United Center, and overall is a pretty solid SummerSlam. Of course, the Bret Owens steel cage match for the WWF title is what most remember and is a classic. Taker vs. Taker was all right, and the build to it with Leslie Nielsen was kind of funny. I like Naked Guns, so what can I say? Razor Diesel for the IC title is pretty good, with Walter Payton in Razor's Corner, and HBK costing Diesel the IC title is memorable, as it would be the beginning of their problems heading into Survivor Series, where it would really come to a head. I like the Luger-Tatanka match from the standpoint of we didn't know which one sold out to Ted DiBiase. It's been a while since I've seen the rest of the card, but overall not a bad SummerSlam.
Dave Hall. Once again, we have a reasonably solid card where the good outshines the bad enough to forget about. Bret and Owen put on one of the greatest cage matches ever. The story was good, and the whole family at ringside added to the drama. Wait, is that? Yes, it's the anvil waiting to attack everyone. The family brawl at the end is great as Bulldog is reintroduced, and another layer to the feud is laid. Razor and Diesel put on a good match as well, with Diesel continuing to improve. Sweetness really added a little to the match, and Shawn nearly steals the spotlight, but Razor regains the belt in a great match thanks to the superkick, which begins a slow turn for Diesel. The Luger-Tatanka storyline was a little obvious, but Tatanka's beatdown after the match was really good. I remember looking forward to the feud, but always felt it fizzled out a little. The Headshrinkers, now beltless, put on a solid opening match. It's too bad they were the ones to suffer at the hands of Diesel and Shawn's storyline, as they could have been a lot more with the Shrinkers as champs. Blaze Nakata was acceptable, but Jarrett Mabel was a joke, and the return of The Undertaker is hurt by the horrible match against Brian the Faker Lee. It's a shame this wasn't earlier in the card. I understand Taker is returning, but the card would have been much better ending with the Hart Brothers cage match. Leslie Nielsen's sketches are enjoyable, and the show that celebrity can be used as comedy without ruining a show.
I agree. The master of the apostrophe, J. Arsenio D'Amato, actually asks one of the most poignant questions in the history of professional wrestling. And that is, how could they break up Bull and Dump?
Bull and Dump, coming to a local theater near you. These two Japanese monsters dominate the ring with their exciting moves and powerful action. However, can they defeat the team of Scott Criscolo, leading the Golden Girls down to the ring, his favorite women?
Well, who did we say Bull and Dump was? It was Matt Rotella and it was somebody else.
Oh,
like, LaRue, look
probably,
back.
I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
If anyone looks like a dump, it's him.
It is quite true. Anyway, the Master of the Apostrophe says, how could they break up Bull and Dump? Abe Knuckleball Schwartz made a brief appearance as a reminder of the 94 baseball strike.
Mm-hmm.
I miss the old school heel turns like Tatanka on Luger. Rest in peace, Sweetness, and Leslie Nielsen, two all-time greats. Yes, that's right. Neither of them are no longer – they're both no longer with us. Peyton died in 99. He had liver cancer. And Leslie Nielsen died
– recently, right?
Last year? Something like that, yeah. He had cancer, too, I think.
Jared Insel with his creepy avatar here. I've always loved the atmosphere this show has, something about the new United Center in Chicago that was just awesome. I agree with that. Overall, the card is pretty solid. Bret versus Owen in the steel cage was obvious match of the night and one of my all-time favorites. It's a shame that Vince just wouldn't let them close the show, and instead that hot Chi-Town crowd had to sit through the dreadful Undertaker versus Underfaker match. I understand how much they have put into building Stangle over the summer. The stuff with Leslie Nielsen was gold, but again, what the fuck, Vince? The IC title match between Razor and Diesel with the antics of HBK and Sweetness Walter Payton was another memorable moment. The rest of the card is pretty mediocre, but nothing offensive. But this still remains one of the better SummerSlam pay-per-views from the WWF's dark years in the mid-90s. One moment that always stuck out to me is when Jim the Anvil Neidhart says, "Ah, shut up," to the officials while he's padlocking the cage door in the post-match activity of Brett versus Owen. This always stuck out to me as absolutely hilarious.
Funny. Neil Trauma says, "It's finally time for the PTB podcast for the first WWE pay-per-view I ever saw live on." Well, pay-per-view. "It was at my friend Eric's house, and we ordered Domino's because we were such fucking marks." Sounds like one of your one of our get-togethers. "And I cheered like crazy for Owen in the main event because I was an awesome mark. I'll always remember predicting the Tatanka heel turn beforehand and thinking I was so smart for getting it right, and my friend insisting that Mabel versus Jeff Jarrett was going to be the best match on the show."
He was a big New Jack Swing fan, apparently.
Yeah, exactly. "Always have fond memories of SummerSlam 94. Apparently, Mike, your friend does too.
Mike, yeah, Wilkinson. Geez. "This show brings SummerSlam back, as Brett and Owen show the world all cage matches don't have to be bloodbaths. The title match should have been last, even with the return of Taker, in my opinion. The Tatanka heel turn was huge at the time, and I thought Luger was turning. Jarrett and Mabel was in the sink." Love the Hall Nash match for the IC title. "Just a nice solid show, and I remember being very happy Taker was back. Also, what the fuck was with Jim Neidhart's pants?" Wow. I think he had some Zubaz classics on at the show.
Yeah, he definitely, yeah. Him with his gut sticking out, he definitely had Zubaz on. Jordan McKinnon. "I don't remember much about this show. About all that stands out is the fantastic cage match between Brett and Owen. Still think it's a shame that it had to be a gimmick match because they could have easily topped their WrestleMania match. A 30 or 40 minute match with a belt on the line and both guys giving everything they had would have been outstanding. The Faker Taker match stunk. It was an awful way to end the show after Brett and Owen tore the house down. Fortunately, the mid-card was kept short. Tatanka's heel turn was so blatantly obvious leading up to the show that it really lost its effect. In the end, a barely average show saved by Brett and Owen." Quickly, though, in hindsight, after it happened, did it seem obvious?
When you look back and put it all together, it did. But at the time, I don't remember thinking going into it that Tatanka was turning, for sure. I thought that they were just going to say DiBiase was lying, kind of like the Flair imperfect thing with Savage or Warrior. I think at the time, that's what I kind of thought. But looking back, obviously, it was clear they were just setting us up for a swerve. Sean Watts, son of your buddy Jim Watts. "Decent show. Don't understand why Mabel was in the show. Isn't as bad as most people say it is."
Okay. Austin Pfaff. "Finally, the power is back, and I'm able to leave feedback for another great show." Yeah, it has been a while for you. "Nice opening tag match. The title's not being defended. Didn't hurt it. Bull Nakano was a beast, but where was Dump?" He was cutting our intros.
He was cutting the meat at LaRue Meat and Deli. Check it out.
"Razor carried Diesel through a good match. Tatanka took the money and ran with it. It was due time for a heel turn. He acted a good heel during the McMemphis time. Candy Girl came up a bit short on a win." I can't believe we just started calling him that now. That's great. "The cage match is one, if not the greatest cage matches of all time. It did not need blood. If it had blood, it probably would have hurt its appeal of the actual match in its case. I know people will bitch about Taker, but I enjoyed it for what it was. Just got to look at it from that point." I can't believe anyone looks at Mabel and they think of Candy Girl. Tremendous.
Oh, boy. You got to love our ever-growing batch of misfits. Brett Carlson, yes, two words. "Oozing machismo. Greatest shirt ever. As far as the show, it sucks that the Taker match was the main event because it was pure awful. Brett Owen was as awesome as it always was. I think everyone is probably on the same page that this was extremely up and down."
You know, Brett, you are a very loyal PTB Nation member, and we love your comments, but you are out of your mind if you think that that was one of the greatest shirts ever. And finally,
I'm going to try and find one for you for Christmas, and then we're going to take a nice picture and put it up on the wall.
Yeah, lovely. While I'm holding the Jim Duggan book written in crayon. Finally, on our page, Kieran Polland.
The Hot Scott.
That's right. "This show took place the month I was born." Jesus. "Which makes this automatically awesome. Luger is made to look like a silly bully. A silly billy. And his D-push
like
continues.
Luger is a silly billy."
"The steel cage match is good, but I find it to be overrated because there's too many escape attempts." Interesting. All right. I'm glad someone said that. Mm. You know, it's good. It's good to have opinions on both sides. Taker is crap, but it's Taker, so it'll have some form of awesomeness to it. We bid adieu to the Macho Man as he ends his WWF career. as he leaves a legend. Indeed.
Okay, now we quickly hop over to Graham Cawthon's History of WWE Facebook page. Jay King Kong's Spudley Wilmette. Loved it. It was a very underrated pay-per-view with Bret and Owen cage match. Taker versus Taker was a good match as well, and the opening tag match was fun.
Okay. Zoo Hodge. Sounds like Bull and Dump's manager. Zoo Hodge. Razor Ramon with Walter Payton versus Diesel with Shawn Michaels. Also a good match.
Paul Fraser, a very good pay-per-view. Loved Taker versus Taker as a kid. A great women's title match. Wasn't sure about Owen versus Bret cage match. Didn't really entertain me.
Okay. And finally, Steve Riddle. SummerSlam 1994 was overall a pretty good show. Riddle me that. The opener was good, even though the starch was taken out when the tag titles were taken off the head shrinkers. The women's title match was solid as both ladies brought it in the ring. Razor Diesel was great from the in-ring action to the antics outside with Michaels and Walter Payton. The next two matches were average as Tatanka Luger was prodding with the most predictable ending ever, while Mabel Jarrett was nothing. The cage match was excellent as Bret and Owen put on another great match, and the visual of the end with the brothers climbing the cage is a great iconic moment. The Taker-Taker match was intriguing from a storyline perspective, but the match wasn't great, and at least the right Taker won. This was a good show, but it is in the middle of the SummerSlam totem pole.
So, we want to go ahead and thank all the great PTB Nation members, as always, for dropping us your comments and feedback on these pay-per-views. Without you, of course, these vintage vaults would not be nearly as good. So, as always, thank you.
Yes.
So, with that said, visit us at the message board, bigelow34.proboards.com. Visit us at the Facebook page, on Twitter, at place2bpodcast. Check out WrestleCast. Check out Graham Cawthon's History of WWE.com. Check out LaRue Meat and Deli as well. Check everything out. That's what we do here. We give happy and healthy plugs. So,
exactly.
With that said, we also want to give a shout out to all the veterans, if any are listening. Happy Veterans
yes.
Day.
And, absolutely. Thank you for your service.
Yes. And happy birthday once again to Matthew Rotella. So, with all that said, we're going to go ahead and wrap things up. We will be back next week with our recap from the live Raw and SmackDown we're going to be attending. We're going to wrap up the big football matchups from this weekend that are going to be happening, and we're going to go ahead and preview the next week and probably catch you a little bit more up on this disgusting Penn State nonsense and the NBA lockout as well. So, for my PIC, Scotty C, I am Justin R. Have a great weekend. We'll talk to you next week.
Peace. The best. Let's stick out Jimmy and see what we can catch. Stick him up, Jimmy. Next, won't be needed unless Jenny wanna get right to the flesh.
So we get that one over there. Get that one, man. Give my money to the people. Give my money to the people. I won't lie. I love B-U-D-T.